Seattle's mayor and other city leaders want more automated traffic cameras to help ease congestion in the city, but of course they need the legislature's permission to do it. And this afternoon, both the House and Senate will hear bills to give the city that permission, and Hannah Scott is here to tell us what that's going to mean.
So Democrat Marco Lias is behind the proposal in the Senate, which would give Seattle the green light to expand traffic camera enforcement.
This is really designed for those places where it's really difficult to get a patrol officer there, you know, to provide one more tool to make sure that folks aren't blocking intersections, blocking pedestrian facilities, you know, blocking those bus-only lanes. Especially in parts of Seattle, it's really tough to get a patrol officer there to police the law because we've got space constraints. And so I think this is just a really common sense way of making sure that people are observing those laws.
So on top of the red light cameras that we have now, as well as the speeding violation cameras, this would allow cameras that for cars that violate bus-only lanes, blocking intersections or blocking the box, crosswalks, and those who block emergency vehicle lanes or the lanes where a bus is unloading and loading passengers. Leah says tickets would be about the same as red light tickets that come from the cameras, around $130.
And just like the red light infractions, it's not considered a moving violation when the camera issues it, so it's more like a parking ticket or something like that. But it is just one more tool.
And the tool is a goal for to ease congestion.
You know, moving people efficiently into the city on those transit-only lanes is really important, especially at rush hour. And if there's a car that's blocking that transit-only lane so that, you know, the bus is carrying hundreds of people, sometimes over the course of an hour, thousands of people, you know, that's having an impact on the commute for a lot of people. And we want to make sure that people respect the rules, stay out of the transit only lanes, and that the buses can operate to get everyone in to downtown and into congested corridors, particularly during rush hour.
A tool or a toll? But I don't know, because I don't know, is there anybody who really wants to block the box? Usually when they end up there, it's a high-pressure situation. I'm very timid about that. I'm not going to venture in unless it's clear on the other side. But sometimes, the way the lights are arranged, you have that green light, and unless you anticipate, traffic would never move ever. Isn't this sometimes a traffic light timing problem more than people just perversely trying to block other people?
I think there's an argument to be made for that, but there's absolutely drivers out there who go when they know they should not go and end up in that intersection. Don't you think, Sully?
Yeah, definitely. And there are also buses.
Yeah.
That do, and my big problem with this, in addition to the camera issue, I don't have as much a problem with that, but I want a uniform, something applied across the board that doesn't just attack drivers. I would like this to also include ticketing pedestrians.
I asked about
who
that.
Who cross illegally, which then causes the cars to not be able to turn, and then when they do turn, they end up blocking the box. I want buses ticketed. I want it to be fairly applied across the law.
They would have to make pedestrians wear license plates.
I asked him, and he said, again, so we want to stress, for privacy, this only snaps a picture of the license plate, and you cannot do that with a person. So
right, that's why I'm against it. You got to make it fair for everybody. No one seems to want to talk about the pedestrian role in our congestion.
So what kind of chance does this have in the legislature, Hannah?
I think it's got a pretty good chance. And I do want to point out, while this is not Seattle asked for this, and this would obviously be piloted likely first by Seattle, this would cover the whole state. So everybody in the state could do this, every municipality. And this also creates a new, so for your fines, I asked about where those are going to go. Those are going to go to a new transportation safety account that basically would only be allowed, that money from your ticket would go to fixing things, making safety improvements for pedestrian, bicycle, and transit lanes, essentially.
Yeah. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You may have heard it said that social media could become addictive to your child and even affect his or her mental health. Let's call him the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. I'm curious how you can study the effects of such a thing. Are there any controlled experiments on this, Dr. Cohen?
There is a new study. It just came out. Before I go any further, I have to tell you, there are a lot of studies on this topic. And the studies show all kinds of different things. But this most recent study, which came out of Canada, was more of a longitudinal study. And so it gives probably a little bit better insight into whether or not social media is actually causing depression. As it stands, there's this notion that social media has really a negative impact on our mental well-being, and it's really a widespread notion. The researchers in this particular study, they sought to try and do it in a more controlled fashion. They looked at both young kids in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and then they also looked at university students. They wrote up a series of questions that focused on how much time they spent on social media on weekdays and weekends, as well as how much time they spent on activities such as watching TV or exercising or doing their homework. And then they also looked at symptoms of depression. They used a standardized scoring tool designed by the Center for Epidemiological Studies, and it's their depression scale. And then they used a similar but more age-appropriate version for the younger participants. They looked at all the data that they collected. They broke it into the different age groups, different gender groups. What they found was that in this really pretty well-done study, all things considered, that social media use didn't actually lead to depressive symptoms later on in life. And this really held true in both groups of participants. The researchers, they also found that in adolescent females, that higher depression symptoms predicted later social media use. From this study, what the authors concluded is that overuse of social media doesn't necessarily lead to depression. Their hope was that this would help to dissuade public fear over the impacts of technology. Now, there's a lot of studies. This is just one study. And it was a more longitudinal study because it was done over time with a pretty large group of patients. But it's really more likely that there are differences in factors such as your personality that play a part in how social media can actually impact your mental well-being. For example, some young people might actually choose to use social media negatively as a comparison tool. They'll see what other people are doing and they'll use it to compare themselves, whereas others may just simply use it to stay in touch with friends. And obviously, there's a kind of a difference in the overall mental health aspects of those two approaches. If you're using it as a comparison tool, that's probably unhealthy. Whereas if you're using it to just stay in touch with friends, that's more healthy.
Well, that makes sense. Because I was going to ask you, merely the amount of time you spend on social media wouldn't be the thing to worry about, seems to me. Although, I mean, if it's keeping you away from, you know, your homework, but it's how you use it. So if you're using it to troll people or, as you say, compare yourself, then that's one thing. If you're using it simply to keep in touch with friends or distant relatives, that's very different.
Right. And one of the things that's clear to me from reading these different studies is it's somewhat of a chicken and an egg kind of question. Are people who are more prone to depression more likely to spend excessive amounts of time on social media, or does social media lead to depression? Now, I just told you about the one study that says that it probably doesn't, but unfortunately, there's conflicting studies. There's conflicting studies to say that social media use does contribute to depression. There are studies that say it does contribute to anxiety and anger and aggressiveness. It can even be addictive. The research community can't even agree on what the definition is of problematic social media use. And without a good definition, it's hard to take it into the next step. But every one of these papers and every one of these studies has tried to come up with their own specific definition and then use that to conduct their own study.
Well, this is why we call you up, Dr. Cohen. You've read the studies, you are a parent yourself, and you're a doctor. So having read through all this, what do you think is a rational way for a parent to tackle this?
As you know, my approach is always to do things in moderation, because I really think that's really the best way to generally take care of your health. You know, how do you approach social media use in moderation when it's become so prevalent? I mean, if you try to do virtually anything online now, even your homework, they oftentimes ask you to sign on with Google or Facebook. So because we've become such a technology-driven society and we spend so much time in front of our computers, whether it's at work, whether it's at school, whether it's doing our homework, whatever, and social media is so present in all of it, it's really hard to determine what moderation actually is.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
He made headlines when he became the first police chief of the state to announce he would not enforce the new gun laws that came with Initiative 1639. And now Republic Police Chief Lauren Culp has a new book expanding on his position. Kyra's Hannah Scott has talked to him. I didn't realize it was enough for a book in this.
Yeah, he believes so. Yeah, it's a 100-page book just dropped this morning called American Cop, And it is on Amazon and also in paperback. It was just over a week after the election that Lauren Culp, the police chief of the small town of Republic in eastern Washington, announced his department would not enforce the new gun laws from 1639, which Culp believes violates both the U.S. Constitution and especially the state constitution.
Article 1, Section 24 of the Washington State Constitution says that the right of the individual citizen to bear arms in defense of himself or the state shall not be impaired. That is one sentence that is very, very clear.
Now, he believes everything from the new age requirement for semi-automatic rifles to safe storage aspects in 1639 violate that and is not backing down from his stand, and continues in this book to call for more law enforcement in the state to follow his lead. In his view, enforcing the gun laws violates every cop's oath of office to uphold and defend the Constitution.
When I saw the lack of response from other police chiefs and sheriffs, you know, in the beginning, that prompted me to write the book because I needed to get my point of view, my perspective out to them, give them what I felt with the situation and why it violated citizens' rights.
And his goal with the book?
I hope to educate the citizens, law enforcement, and elected officials, anyone who's taken an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, as well as the people that they work for. And that's very important that elected officials and the police officers remember that they work for the citizens. I hope to educate all of them to better know their rights and their responsibilities, because there is a rabid assault on our rights right now, not just in Washington State, but all across our country.
So we often hear from critics that the Second Amendment was enacted in a different time period and needs updating. Others argue it outright needs to be repealed. Chief Culp calls that ridiculous.
Self-defense never goes out of style, ever. And our government did not give us the right to bear arms, the right to defend ourselves, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. None of those things were given to us by our government. The people created government in our founding to protect our rights. That's the purpose of government.
But with all the gun violence in our country, I asked him, why not follow Australia's lead, you know, where guns are very much restricted and not allowed for self-defense?
Well, I would ask the Native Americans how they would feel about that. Do you trust your government? I would ask the Jewish people who were slaughtered by the Nazis, do you trust your government to disarm you and take care of you?
The chief firmly believes in the argument that only a good guy with a gun can stop a bad guy with a gun. Another issue he targets in the book, what he calls the idiocy of gun-free zones.
It only disarms the law-abiding citizen. If I'm a law-abiding citizen and I go somewhere and I see a sign out front that says guns are not allowed, I'm not going to go in there with my firearm because I don't want to be a criminal. I don't want to be charged with a crime, right? So if a criminal shows up and he's intent on doing harm to people, that sign's not going to stop him.
So more than a dozen cops in the state have now followed his lead and have joined him in refusing to enforce 1639, for some at least until the lawsuit that's currently happening is played out. But both the governor and the state attorney general came out last week and slammed that position.
My job was to enforce it and to set aside my personal views, deeply held and deep reservations about the constitutionality of death penalty, and do my job. That is the expectation that the governor has, that I have, that everybody here has, and everybody who voted along with Paul for Initiative 1639 has for each one of those elected officials.
And what I'm here to say is the law is going to be followed even if these sheriffs go AWOL and don't do their jobs. That's the most important thing for me to say.
And Chief Culp told me he was unconcerned with that and will continue his push and will refuse to enforce any new laws that may come out of the legislature this session that he also believes are unconstitutional.
Yeah. Well, the Second Amendment certainly says nothing about concealed carry permits or background checks. So is he going to suspend those requirements as well?
Well, in his particular case, background checks are done by the county sheriff, Ferry County Sheriff. It's not something he has to do, so it doesn't really pertain to him. His specific...
So he doesn't think there should be background checks either, or any restrictions based on your mental health or whether you are convicted of domestic violence or things like that. Huh?
He doesn't speak out against background checks. He believes that you know, he says they already happen. It's just not his particular job to do it. He's specifically targeting, he doesn't think.
But he wrote a book about it, so there's got to be a philosophy involved here. And if he's saying that he's taking the word shall not be infringed to be literal, saying there shouldn't be anything between you and the gun. I suppose if you want to be literal about it, then it should be made a right like health care, and you should be able to be to arm yourself regardless of income. Some of those firearms can be pretty darned expensive. But so no background checks, that would imply to me, and no restrictions based on what, gang membership, your status as a felon? Or
no, if you're a criminal, and I see what you're going for here based on that.
We've passed all sorts of laws that infringe people's rights based on the fact that they have proven they're not trustworthy enough to have a firearm.
If you have committed a crime, then absolutely he would support that as a law enforcement officer. But if you've not committed a crime, then he believes that you have that right to bear arms and that cannot be infringed upon based on our state constitution.
Okay,
and the U.S. Constitution.
Okay, so he will continue to arrest gang members who were...
Yes, absolutely.
Or anybody, or people under the age of 21 caught with a pistol, for example?
No, he doesn't believe that's a crime. Oh, that is what he believes, infringes on that. And I asked him, because the question I always get when I talk about folks on the gun right side is, what about handguns? You have to be 21 to have a handgun. Yeah. Why isn't it any different for the semi-automatic? He believes the handgun regulation for 21-year-olds is also unconstitutional.
And on the types of weapons that people should be allowed to have, obviously he's in favor of semi-automatics, but what about fully automatic?
We did not discuss fully automatics. It's against the law, so he didn't weigh in on that with me. But
the law says shall not be infringed. That's the supreme law of the land. And it doesn't specify that certain weapons are worse than others.
No, and then, and he would make the same argument. He has the argument with 1639 defining certain semi-automatic rifles as assault rifles. He doesn't, and he doesn't like that definition either.
Do we have a copy of the book? I should leave.
It just came out. It's up on Amazon right now again, called American Cop. I also want to point out, remember, he had asked his city council to declare a Second Amendment sanctuary city in this town of Republic. Uh-huh. That city council is meeting tomorrow night, and that is expected to come up. So I'll keep you posted.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Got radio's Hannah Scott.
Your daily dose of kindness now. 2-year-old Samantha Savitz loves to talk to anyone who knows sign language. And if somebody doesn't, well, it makes her a little sad, which is why her neighbors undertook what can only be described as the most generous community project. And here's CBS's Steve Hartman with the story.
At the far end of Islington Road in Newton, Massachusetts, lives a little girl near and dear to the neighborhood. 2-year-old Samantha Savitz is deaf, but boy, does she love to talk to anyone who knows sign language. Her parents, Raphael and Glenda.
Yeah, she's super engaging. She wants to, chat up with anybody.
Yeah, her whole personality changes when it's someone who can communicate with her.
Likewise, if someone can't, well, that makes Sam just a little sad. Her desire for engagement has been painfully obvious to everyone in the neighborhood. Whenever they see her on a walker in her yard and Sam tries to be neighborly, they find themselves at a frustrating loss for words.
I didn't know what to say back. Wouldn't you like to talk to her?
Basic conversation that one would have with a child.
Asking her about her day.
And make her feel that she is part of the neighborhood. Just be her friend.
Unfortunately, this isn't something you can solve with a casserole. You'd need the whole community to learn sign language, just for a little 2-year-old girl. Can't expect neighbors to do that. You can only appreciate them when they do. On their own, Sam's neighbors got together, hired an instructor, and are now fully immersed in an American Sign Language class. The teacher, Reese McGovern, says this is remarkable because a lot of times even the parents of deaf children don't bother to learn sign language.
But here, Sam has a full community that's signing and communicating with her and her family, and it is a beautiful story.
And he says this level of inclusion will almost certainly guarantee a happier, more well-adjusted Sam, which is why her parents say there aren't words in any language to express their gratitude.
It's really shocking and beautiful.
We are so fortunate.
In fact, they say they're already seeing a difference in their daughter.
You should see her when she comes in at the end of class.
The first thing she says to us is, "Friend."
I think your heart would melt just as mine did.
Sometimes it feels like America is losing its sense of community. But then you hear about a place like this, where the village it takes to raise a child is alive and well and here to remind us that what makes a good neighborhood is nothing more than good neighbors. Steve Hartman on the road in Newton, Massachusetts.
You see the pictures of that town? Looks like yes. Bedford Falls in A Wonderful Life.
Of course, I watched this on CBS Sunday. He told this story just yesterday morning. And I always say it's not Sunday morning unless Steve Hartman makes me cry and Mo Rocca makes me laugh.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is, back in the saddle, Danny O'Neill. Ichiro has reported to Mariners training camp.
He certainly has.
With only 7% body fat. And it says here, what's the source of this? MyNorthwest.com. So you know it's true. He's in the best shape of anybody on the team.
That's not surprising. You've seen Ichiro. Man takes immaculate care of himself.
Yeah, but you said, but the, when I've asked you, like, so is he really angling to be in the lineup? You're saying, no, not really.
Well, he's angling. I just don't want him there.
Why?
Because he's old. This is past his prime.
Best shape of anybody on the team. Look, age is only a number.
Well, is it? It's 45. He's 45 years old. Like, he's going to keep playing until he's 50. Here's what I would say. I think it's a bad sign for the team if he plays well enough to make the team, because the past 2 years, it's basically been clear that he's not really a rotational player anymore. He's not a functional major league part.
Then why is the headline on one of these stories, he's like a folk hero, 45-year-old Ichiro continues to awe at Mariners spring training?
Well, you've got a ton of players that look at him and think, oh my gosh, I can't believe that he's 45 and still doing this.
So that's where the awe comes from, not from his effectiveness.
Right. He's not. Unless he is markedly better than he was a year ago, he's not going to be a functional major league player. He's going to go over to Japan when the Mariners will be there for spring training. There's no downside to this. They get extra roster spots when they're in Japan. They'll play two games that are meaningful regular season games. The expectation is he's going to play with them. I would be shocked if he is part of the 25-man roster when the team comes back.
So what is it where is he lacking? So I mean, he can't hit anymore, or he can't catch. I mean, what is it what goes?
His defense was exceptional before, and he's probably probably around average, maybe slightly above average defender now. Mm-hmm. And his on-base percentage, he never walked a ton. So his on-base percentage has never been as great. He's had to hit for an incredibly high average to make his lack of power worthwhile. We have a statistical measurement for what you would call a replacement player. And that's a guy that you could find on the street or in your crawl space, somebody that would be available to every major league team at a league minimum salary. And last year, Ichiro performed below that. So it's a metric.
No, there are objective ways of measuring your effectiveness.
How his contribution is. And he is no longer getting on base. And because he hits for very little power, his on-base percentage has to be, his batting average has to be really above 300 for him to be a valuable and continuous major league part.
So what have we picked up about the team as it's shaping up right now?
You're going to be very young. You're going to have a very exciting lineup. The bullpen is a mess, and that's not a surprise. I think they knew that over the course of the offseason. There's a lot of young players that are going to be very fun to watch. Whether it's Yusei Kikuchi, who is...
Also fun to say.
It is. You say it. Yusei Kikuchi.
Yusei Kikuchi. I say Kikuchi.
I say left-handed starting pitcher.
Yes.
Fresh over here from Japan. There's going to be a lot of fun players to watch. Are they going to contend? No, I don't think they're going to be a team that, hey, you know, they're going to win 90 games and make the playoffs. Mm. I think they'll be exciting to watch, but the bullpen is going to be the impediment. That's going to be really the thing that holds them back.
Well, since we lost the Maple Grove, I think we can probably form the Kikuchi-Kuchi-Koo corner, right?
I had not heard that one yet. That is very, very good. Yeah.
Everybody gets a little handsy with consent, of course. Coochie coochie coo. Don't you like it?
I do like it.
You can hear that chant from Safeco Field right now.
Yeah. I think you've done it again, Colleen.
Thank you.
Who is Evan White?
Evan White is a first baseman. Great defensive prospect. He started hitting really well last year. Look, if he starts to hit, he was an early round pick 2 years ago out of Kentucky. I'm fairly certain, University of Kentucky. And he's someone who profiles as a potential. The Mariners have four guys who are on the Baseball America top 100 prospects, and he's one of them. He's probably not going to make the big league team this year, but the fact that he hit and hit with some power last year was a really encouraging sign.
Okay, so that's good news. And just to change sports for a moment, UW beat Wazoo.
Yeah, they did on a last-minute putback. Noah Dickerson put back a miss by Jalen Noel, And the Huskies now 11-1 in conference play.
So that's really good.
Yes, it is. They're angling for the top seed in the Pac-12 tournament. Had a slip up against Arizona State last week, but back on the horse. They've got Utah this week at home on Wednesday. They're getting down to the nitty-gritty of it, and they're looking really good.
When do we get brackets and all that?
Brackets will come out first weekend in March.
Okay, so we still have some time.
Still a couple weeks away from that.
Okay, but they're contenders.
Oh, of course they are. I would be surprised if they don't make the tournament at this point.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That's good. How many years have they done that?
They haven't done it since 2011. Ooh. Yeah. That's, you remember Romar? That's why he got fired, because he couldn't make the tournament. Despite having first-round NBA picks, he couldn't make the tourney. Then he won two games in the Pac-12, and two wins in the Pac-12 gets you fired, Dave.
Yeah. Well, good for them. You got to feel a little sad for the Cougs, though.
Why?
Well, because they Cougged it. Which is not good.
Yeah.
I want to bring both sides of the state together.
No, everybody doesn't get happy.
Just encourage him, Danny. He's trying to be competitive right now in the sports arena.
I do like the fact I do like the fact that you used Cougan. That was impressive.
Meanest thing I've heard Dave say during Sports Insider.
You've got to get rid of the sympathy part for it, though. And just go like this.
Yeah, I just stole it from the sports page. Oh. Really not mine. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
This is Yale's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. One of the pieces of legislation being proposed in the legislature at the behest of the governor is being called the Welcome to Washington Baby Act of 2019. Apparently, the idea here is that every family who has a newborn between birth and 9 months old will be required to have a visit from a nurse who can offer services, whatever other help they may need. And Senator Shelley Short, who represents the 7th District, had some concerns about that.
Develop a program where people are going to come into your home when you have that brand new baby. And to me, it's very intrusive. The program is voluntary, but you have to opt out.
So we've called up Senator Short. So you're concerned that this is an invasion of privacy?
Absolutely, without question. You know, you're going to allow a nurse to come into your home, and we don't know what they're going to be looking for because they're very vague. They said, obviously, they want to deal with the health, safety, and immediate needs of the child and the family, which sounds good. But based on evidence-based standards, well, what does that mean? To me, it's very subjective. Are they going to make judgment about the home you live in or how you heat your home or if you have firearms in your house for protection? I mean, we really don't know what these people are going to be looking for because it's very vague.
The idea, I'm assuming here, is to head off problems before they start. We've seen, of course, cases of child abuse, cases of child neglect where somebody's living in poverty. And it's one thing to live in poverty, but it's another thing for a parent, like, never to feed you or to be overwhelmed. And so my guess is that this is to try and head those problems off early. Is that not our responsibility?
Oh, sure. I wouldn't disagree with that. And actually, I want to let your listeners know that, in fact, there is already a program in Washington State designed to do that, but it's not expansive to all newborns. The legislation actually, they identify thousands of families that are in need of help. Well, why not use the existing program that's been working very well, put additional funding into it to reach those thousands of families? If you create a statewide universal program, I want your listeners to think about how many families we have in Washington State. We have 2.7 million family households in Washington State. They want to reach thousands of, you know, families that they believe should be connected to these services. My concern is instead of just upgrading the current program that we have, maybe with additional funding and staffing, I feel those families who are going to need the help most, just like you said, are going to fall through the cracks because they're creating this expansive program. By the way, $43 million to actually put this program into place, that's not money needed for additional services. That's just to put a new program in DSHS in place.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the cost is going to be a concern, but in terms of falling through the cracks, the legislation specifically says this must be universal, so nobody would fall through the cracks. It sounds like you're worried that the opposite thing is the problem, that too many people are being covered by this.
Well, when have you known, you know, of a state program or a federal program that is designed to cover all of these individuals that does. I think that's really setting up a program to fail. Again, I absolutely believe if there are concerns with a family or the family's overwhelmed, you know, they should get help. I'm not.
But then how do you find them? Because the problem is that they may not ask for it.
Well, actually, that's a good point, but I would push back a bit, because there are many different ways that these families can be identified. They can be identified through Head Start. They can be identified as families who are already working to obtain services. Those families can be found through just the medical checks and the things that they do. Teachers in school, community members, teachers, healthcare providers, and the like, daycare providers are required to report. So I think we actually have a number of things that are in place to identify those families and to get them the help that they need. Again, not opposed to that,
right.
But I don't know about you, but when I was sitting in a hospital and just had my children, they're adults, by the way, but you're overwhelmed as a parent. You've got paperwork being thrown at you. Are people going to take the time and read through the paperwork to understand really what they're potentially, you know, may opting into? Well, obviously there's no opt-in, it's opt-out.
Right.
I just think they may not be prepared for what that visit's going to be. And I think there are a lot of judgment calls the state makes on what they feel are appropriate education tools. You know, they want everything to be one size fits all. They want childcare to be all the same. They want education to be all the same. There are judgment calls that are made every day as to whether you're a good parent just because you teach your children differently, or maybe you opt out of having your children have vaccines. That's a hot topic today.
One of the things that I've discovered in covering the homelessness problem is that Seattle is unique in that we have this phenomenon of homeless families with children, which I'm told by our Seattle homelessness consultant is no other city deals with that. And I have a feeling that part of the reason for a bill like this is to try and spare us the further embarrassment of seeing that happen every day. And the things that you mentioned, the reporting requirements, that, I mean, that's obviously good, but it happens after the child's gotten into some kind of public school or daycare setting. If a child never gets into those settings, then this may be going on, well, in private. I guess, you know, families have a right to raise their kids as they wish, but if it gets to the point where that child is being neglected or abused, you know, what would be the harm? I guess you could look at it as we don't like DUI checkpoints in this state, even though it may reduce the number of drivers. You're just saying that this is similar to that.
Well, it isn't a matter of fact, and I'd like to, you know, offer a thought. You know, we have all seen Child Protective Services go after families they shouldn't, and ignore families they should actually, in fact, go after, because there has been heinous abuse and things that have happened. But for the folks that get caught up in the system where, you know, maybe a spouse is angry at a spouse, so they turn them into CPS, or a child's angry at a grandparent. Do you realize once that information is in the system, it follows you forever? We have attempted to get things expunged, things that were families have found not to be correct. They were investigated. They were non-founded. And there is nothing in the state of Washington to take that information out of the system. It follows you forever. So I still keep going back to, you know, that person making that judgment call, sitting in that person's home, you know, and then what happens with that information? You know, and
so you just don't trust the State Department of Social and Health Services to run a program
absolutely
like this?
Absolutely not. Again, I do want those families to get help. But if they would have just simply taken an opt-in, to me, that would have been a much more pragmatic approach to the families that really felt like they might need that assistance, instead of just lumping everybody into that category.
All right. Senator Shelley Short, who represents the 7th District, north of Spokane. Senator Short, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dave. You take care.